Peter B. Collins. News and comment. It's Monday, August 17, 2015. We've had a heat wave here in California, and there are hot spots all around the globe. And for us, we've also got smoke in the air.
Cause your eyes had a mist from the smoke of a distant fire.
From the Peter B. Collins Tax Deductible Music Archives, we take you back to the mid-1970s for the Sanford Townsend Band and Smoke from a Distant Fire. And over the weekend, we had 100-degree temperatures in the temperate San Francisco Bay Area. It was 112 yesterday afternoon here in Marin County. And our air quality has been just sucky. Because of the wildfires, they're getting them more under control. But we've had an inversion the last few days so that the air has been completely still, temperatures skyrocketing. And it has actually made things a little better for the firefighters simply because the winds have not been, expanding the fire lines. But around the world, we're seeing that this could be once again the hottest year on record because the heat waves that we're seeing, like 120 degrees in Baghdad, and it's been that way for almost 3 weeks. And when you include the heat index, which is kind of the flip side of the wind chill factor that we talk about in the winter, they're saying that the heat dome that has settled over Iran and Iraq has clocked in at a heat index of 165 degrees. And that, of course, when you add in hefty humidity with temperatures over 115 degrees Fahrenheit, well, it is oppressive. And I guess I'm some kind of a lightweight because over the weekend I was lethargic. I was sitting in front of a fan sipping iced tea and just waiting for things to cool off. And I'm kind of happy to be at work today because my office and studio here are air-conditioned. My home is not. Now, there are other conditions in Tokyo. They've had 8 straight days of 95-degree weather. In South Korea, an all-time high for the first week of August, with dozens of deaths reported. And I'm just scanning the globe here for some of these reports. Europe let's see what they're telling us. It's virtually certain that the heat wave that struck Europe in early July is more likely due to climate change. Well, that's a no-brainer for me. I know some of my listeners, including some of you who are, heartfelt progressives and very well informed, you think it's some kind of a scam. But I think the planet clearly is heating up. And what was so ridiculous over the weekend, we heard Republican presidential candidates out there at the Iowa State Fair lecturing California, saying that the reason we're having wildfires and a serious drought is because we haven't built enough reservoirs. And I mean, that doesn't pass a kindergarten exit exam. The real reason that we're in bad shape in California is that the last 2 winters we have not had any serious snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. That's what fills our reservoirs, and building more of them isn't going to collect water that doesn't exist. So it's sad to see people pander for political purposes to the deniers of climate change when we clearly need to face the reality. Jason Leopold gave me another great interview today, and I'm releasing it to subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And he details his blockbuster article published last week at Vice News about the Google search that made the CIA spy on the U.S. Senate. I think this is a very important story on many levels. First and foremost, it hammers once again the credibility of America's top spooks. We have James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, the top dog in the spy community, the proven perjurer. And Jason Leopold's lengthy piece, it's 8,000 words. I encourage you to read it, find a little time to absorb it all. But he shows that the credibility of John Brennan, the CIA director, is shredded. This all comes out of the conflict with the Senate Intelligence Committee over its so-called review of rendition, torture, and interrogation, including the waterboarding of certain suspects, and other techniques that clearly cross the line into torture. And what is fascinating is that FOIA junkie Jason Leopold got 400 or 500 pages of documents from the CIA based on his requests about the so-called Panetta Review. And the CIA says that it mistakenly included a draft letter written by Director Brennan, which he never signed and never mailed, which was an apology for wrongdoing by the CIA in this contested situation. Here's Jason describing the Brennan apology letter.
I knew that the CIA had given Senator Feinstein a courtesy copy of all the documents they turned over to me. And many of these documents were marked confidential, secret, classified, top secret. So, it's important to note that they declassified this. But this letter, this John Brennan letter, did not have any markings on it, Peter. So I thought that was odd. And it wasn't until I spoke to Senator Feinstein's office and they informed me that, do you know this letter that you have here that's dated July 28th, in which John Brennan apologizes for the actions of CIA officers? And I said, yes, I'm looking at it right now. They said, well, we never received that letter. And I said, what? they said, we never received that letter. We never received any apology. We never received any assurances from John Brennan that he was going to address these shortcomings. What they did receive was a different letter that was strikingly different in tone 3 days later, 3 or 4 days later, August 1st. And that letter was also included in the cache. And it simply said, I'm going to stand up an accountability review board to look at this.
You can hear the full interview with Jason Leopold. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you pull up the Peter B. Collins podcast. And I'm linking to Jason Leopold's powerful story in the show file for this podcast and the interview podcast, which I say is available today. And there is so much more in this article about the $40 million that the CIA paid to a favored contractor, essentially to filter the emails and try to prevent what happened, the release of the Panetta Review, which basically confirmed that the CIA itself knew that torture didn't produce intelligence. That's the whole bottom line of the Feinstein Intelligence Review. And the Panetta Review agrees with the Intelligence Committee findings and not with the representations of John Brennan, the CIA itself, and the former CIA officials who have a new book coming out in the next couple of weeks where they try to make the case that torture worked and that it was legal because they had a memo from the Justice Department that said so. Also, on the surveillance front, a very important story front-paged on Sunday's New York Times. Some heavy hitters, including Charlie Savage and James Risen and Laura Poitras, were part of the reporting team. And I'll note that this is another confirmation of something we reported here years ago. And that the confirmations are based on documents provided by Ed Snowden. And you just heard me ranting a moment ago about James Clapper lying under oath before the Senate. It was that event of perjury that pushed Ed Snowden to leave his job, give all this information to Greenwald, Poitras, and other outlets. And we have to put it in that context. So this New York Times story is very significant. I want to correct some of what it said because it opens with this statement. The National Security Agency's ability to spy on vast quantities of internet traffic passing through the U.S. has relied on its extraordinary decades-long partnership with the telecom giant AT&T. Well, it says internet traffic. They captured voice traffic in the same manner. And what this report shows is that AT&T was a willing partner, not just under duress because of the FISA court, and their collaboration goes way back under a program called Fairview that started in 1985. And so out of the gate right after 9/11, AT&T is right there. They don't need a warrant. They got involved in the so-called warrantless wiretapping within days of the September 11th events. And this article also says that the interception, which was first revealed by Mark Klein, an AT&T technician here in San Francisco, and I got one of the early interviews with Klein back in 2006 or 2007. He wrote a book that I still have on my shelf, Wiring Up the Big Brother Machine. And Mark Klein is a real hero, always has been. And he got James Risen to publish some of this information back in 2006 after the L.A. Times, then headed by Dean Baquet, who now runs the New York Times. He's the top editor there. Dean Baquet not only refused to run any of the information supplied by Mark Klein, he turned over some of the information to the government. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that a free press? So this article has a lot of details. Another thing that it says is that AT&T just handed off $400 billion internet metadata records, which include who contacted whom and other details, but not what they said. I don't believe this. And my simple evidence is anybody who's had an email bounce, you see it come back from Mailer Damon. And not only is your email there, but all kinds of gobbledygook and gibberish, all this code that is written. And along with the code that shows where the email went and why it bounced back, is the contents of that email. And consider email threads, all right, where you hit reply all and there are 42 people copied on it. Well, all of those email addresses are coughed up to the government. And everybody's comments that are added to that thread are exposed as a part of that. And the idea that they're only getting the metadata, my email address and who I sent it to, I'm sorry, that doesn't pass an elementary, the test of an elementary knowledge of how the internet works. It also reveals that AT&T pre-sifts the internet data before it sends it to the NSA. That makes AT&T a spy agency. Now, they may only be doing broad term searches and things like that, but instead of handing over the raw data and letting the government do the spying on American citizens, AT&T helps out. Yeah. It is just amazing. This is a sordid note. As we mentioned last week, the Obama administration has officially decided to ask a federal judge not to release Tariq Ba-Odah from Guantanamo Bay. He's been on a hunger strike since 2007. He weighs less than 75 pounds. Have they say, no, we can't relax our standards if we release this guy. It'll only encourage others to conduct hunger strikes. And so that kind of paternalistic, condescending thinking that says, well, his rights as a human being are not as important as maintaining standards and setting examples for the rest of the people who are unlawfully held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And you know, Obama says he wants to close Guantanamo. Well, the best way to achieve that is to let these people out. And Ba-Odah has been cleared for release for a long time, I believe, by both the Bush and the Obama review teams. He is being held there simply because he is Yemeni. And they claim they can't find a place to send him. I'd like to know how hard they've tried. Meanwhile, the Palestinian man who is on a hunger strike in an Israeli prison where he's being held under the draconian detention law without trial or charge, it's called administrative detention, 31-year-old Mohammed Alan drifted into a coma. And so doctors who had refused to force feed him instead put him on a ventilator and hooked him up to a fluid IV. They're saying that that doesn't violate their ethics like force feeding would, but it will force him to remain alive. And I fundamentally believe that any human being, particularly a person who is in prison and who is powerless, has every right to reject sustenance as a form of protest. It is his life. And if he wants to forfeit it, to sacrifice it in this way, I think that we have to respect that. There's no respect coming from the State of Israel and the Netanyahu government to the United Nations, because they have appointed a guy who would be the equivalent of John Bolton, but even worse. His name is Danny Dannon. He's a member of the Knesset. He's actually a political rival of Netanyahu. But he is a reliable, radical Zionist. And so Netanyahu has appointed him to be ambassador to the United Nations. Danny Dannon will be there this September for the General Assembly. And he is a racist and a hothead, in my opinion. Now, there's another right-winger in Israel, I don't want to confuse the two. His name is Danny, D-A-N-I, Dayan, D-A-Y-A-N, like Moshe Dayan. And he is a former leader of the Settler Council who staunchly rejects a Palestinian state. He was named as ambassador to Brazil. So the Netanyahu government is shaping up as all hardliner all the time. And I want to take a moment here to read a couple of passages from Max Blumenthal's important book called Goliath. Because I remember when I read it that Danny Dannon comes up several times. And here's one passage. Blumenthal writes, In a society where assimilation was officially discouraged, social friction naturally accompanied the increased Arab presence, with the rare mixed Jewish-Muslim relationship exacerbating the situation. But there was no evidence to support wild claims like the kind leveled by Likudnik member of Knesset Danny Dannon, who announced from the parliament floor that Bedouins were responsible for 1,000 kidnappings of Jewish girls each year. Indeed, there was no factual basis to claim that Jewish-Arab relationships or marriages were on the rise, or that they were responsible for any of the troubles afflicting blue-collar communities. If anything, by spreading fear of widespread kidnappings, casting the daughters of Israel as prey for Arab predators, right-wing elements distracted from the real sources of the myriad economic problems facing working-class Israelis. And in another passage from Blumenthal's book called Goliath, he talks about, this is in May of 2012, and there was a sequence of events where Israeli youths were terrorizing Africans in Tel Aviv. And so on May 23rd, a crowd of at least 1,000 demonstrators gathered in South Tel Aviv for the largest protest ever held against the presence of Africans in Israel. Besides Ben Ari, the crowd heard from Danny Dannon, the right-wing Knesset member who served as chairman of World Likud, who proclaimed, "The infiltrators have to be expelled. We shouldn't be afraid to say that word. Expulsion now." That's a fundamental statement of racism. It's not even veiled racism. And this is who Netanyahu has appointed Danny Dannon to be UN ambassador. He's not a diplomat. That is very, very clear. And speaking of Max Blumenthal, he has a new book out. I think it's called 51 Days of Gaza, or something like that. And they're getting a copy to me. I hope to interview him in the near future. But I found on my bookshelf one extra copy of the book Goliath. And I want to throw out a special offer today. If you subscribe to the Peter B. Collins podcast with a new annual subscription, and you are the first to do so in the next 48 hours, we'll say by Wednesday of this week, and you send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com, telling me that you took out a new subscription and you would like a copy of Max Blumenthal's Goliath. I only have one, But if you are the first, I would be delighted to send you a copy. And I'd like to thank some of our subscribers here, including Joe Carson, Andy Krieger, and Annette McManus. They're all supporters of the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I am very pleased to acknowledge that. Well, it's a bloody day. There was another big bombing in Baghdad. And for the second day in a row, Syrian jets have bombed the opposition-held Damascus suburb of Douma. More than 100 people have been killed in these deadly attacks. And the Syrians are using a tactic that the U.S. has used in drone strikes, where they hit a civilian target once, and as people try to help the wounded and tend to the dead, they hit them again. And this attack on a marketplace is seen as, in a barbaric war, one of the worst recent events. Stephen O'Brien, the UN's humanitarian official, just ended a three-day visit to Damascus. "I'm particularly appalled," he said, "by reports of airstrikes causing scores of civilian deaths and hundreds injured." That's terrorism. That is state-imposed terrorism. State, not sponsored, but that's that's what that is. And it's part of the ongoing struggle in Syria. Around the world, in Bangkok, a bombing against the military dictators who run that country now killed at least 19 people at the Erawan Shrine near Bangkok. And in Egypt, the military dictator there, a great friend of the United States, General al-Sisi, has, by decree, imposed a new anti-terrorism law. There is no parliament there. No messy process of trying to round up votes and get a bill passed. Nope. President Sisi has approved a controversial anti-terrorism law, which sets up special fast-track courts, boosts police and judicial powers, and imposes hefty fines for so-called false media reports. And this measure is very extreme. It simply consolidates the authoritarian police state powers that al-Sisi has grabbed there in Egypt. And we keep sending him money. We keep basically supporting this guy and the repressive regime that he launched a little over 2 years ago. And we still haven't found the courage, at least not among elected officials and diplomats in the United States, to call that coup a coup. And al-Sisi's new fast track will hit journalists hard. They could be fined for contradicting the authorities' version of any militant attack. And it looks like the Pentagon is trying to keep up with the Egyptians. Now, I want to thank Carl Howard, a great supporter and subscriber to the Peter B. Collins podcast, because he posted this on my Facebook page last week. The Pentagon has published an 1,100-page document called the Law of War. It is a manual. And in it, the guidelines on the treatment of journalists are really scary. The manual says that journalists are generally regarded as civilians, but may in some instances be deemed unprivileged belligerents, a legal term that applies to fighters afforded fewer protections than the declared combatants in a war. The manual warns that reporting on military operations can be very similar to collecting intelligence or spying, and so it calls on journalists to act openly and with the permission of relevant authorities. Authoritarian leaders around the world, like General al-Sisi in Egypt, could point to this and show that the despotic treatment of journalists is broadly in line with standards set here in the United States. And just one more bite. The document suggests that reporters covering wars should operate only with permission of relevant authorities or risk being regarded as spies. For the Pentagon to conflate espionage with journalism feeds into the propaganda of authoritarian governments. I think we've got one of those right here in the good old U.S. of A. Just ask Chelsea Manning. She is facing a disciplinary hearing tomorrow at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, where she is serving her 35-year sentence for being the source of WikiLeaks disclosures. And as we reported to you last week, she got busted for having an expired tube of toothpaste. I mean, this is so insulting to any objective American. Also, they confiscated property from her cell, including the book I Am Malala, the Caitlyn Jenner issue of Vanity Fair, a copy of Out magazine, and the U.S. Senate report on torture. And Chelsea Manning relayed messages that were tweeted on her behalf. Prison staff are now denying me access to the law library with only 2 days until my board. Now, I'm not sure if she chose to represent herself or if that's the way it works in a disciplinary hearing like this, but to be denied access to a law library seems like a fundamental violation of the obvious human rights of Chelsea Manning. I'm disappointed by this, and as you may know, I'm not a sports fan. I don't cover sports on this podcast. But a while back, I think it was about a year ago, members of the football team at my alma mater, Northwestern University outside Chicago, filed documents, a petition with the National Labor Relations Board seeking to be represented by a union, saying we're university employees. The sports program brings in tens of millions of dollars. We're not even compensated for that. We don't get fundamental protection from injury or liability down term for concussions, that sort of thing. I'm really sad that the NLRB ducked this issue in a unanimous decision. They said, well, you know, this would really mess up college sports if we allow one team to collectively bargain. Hey, let them all collectively bargain. I mean, essentially, they'll be across the table from the beer companies. That's who provides all the money for the big money college sports. Also, the NLRB, which has jurisdiction only over the private sector, is said to be reluctant to wade into territory that would have affected public universities. Now, they handled this in a way where they could reopen the case later. And I hope they will. Well, yesterday, Donald Trump proved that he can advance stupid policies just like his Republican counterparts seeking the presidential nomination. Now, at least he went beyond his sound bites and his hateful comments about Mexicans. But like so many right-wingers, he frames everything about immigration policy around our southern border as if that's the only place that undocumented immigrants come from. And we know it's not true. In fact, because of the downturn since 2008, migration across the southern border has declined so sharply that once again, like we saw in the 1990s, the biggest source of people who stay illegally are those who come on a tourist or other visa and don't go back. And they come in at airports from Europe, from Asia, not up over the Rio Grande or riding that train called the Beast through Mexico. But, excuse me, I'm being rational. And that has no no role in Donald Trump's announcement about his immigration plans. So, first of all, he's going to deport every undocumented citizen, every undocumented resident in this country. Good luck with that, Don. Then he is going to triple the immigration enforcement forces. Well, that's been done already. I think that under Obama and Bush, we have doubled the number of Border Patrol officers. And he wants to build a wall across the southern border and make Mexicans pay for it by charging more for admission to the United States. Now, I'll remind those of you with limited recall that the Senate passed a bad immigration bill. I didn't support it, but the House refused to even consider it. And in that Senate bill was $39 or $40 billion for beefing up the southern border. That was something that Obama had agreed to. Again, I don't support that, but the Republicans, who have made immigration a political issue for obvious reasons, hoping to extract political gain, they ignore the proposals that were on the table, and that John Boehner would not allow the House to even consider. And so now Trump, the cartoon character, steps up and promotes all of the same kind of ideas. And it's treated like a breath of fresh air. That's what people say. Donald Trump, he's a breath of fresh air. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the podcast that you're free to share with absolutely anyone, and I hope you will. Put it up on Facebook. Click that like button. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.